Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Netta Ulibi. You can subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week, HBO's epic new series, Boardwalk Empire, is set among the glitz and grime of Atlantic City during Prohibition. Amy Ryan and Philip Seymour Hoffman discuss their latest movie, Jack Goes Boating. And how do directors make online dramas interesting as films? But first,
As the World Turns was broadcast for the last time yesterday. It was a chance for the soap opera's loyal fans to get their last glimpse of the fictional town of Oakdale, Illinois. For 54 years, Oakdale's been the setting for over-the-top tales of romance, intrigue, backstabbing. So many episodes that for some viewers, the place became real. Lara Pellegrinelli took a fantasy trip to the fictional Oakdale to say goodbye.
I've lived in Fairlawn, New Jersey, Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Richmond, Virginia. But I've always gone home to Oakdale.
And now for the next 30 minutes, as the world turns.
My mom started visiting there as a sophomore in high school. And when I was born, she started taking me with her. Even when I got tired of the people in Oakdale, I knew them, and it was easy to imagine that they knew me. In my mind, I could always find a friend like Lisa, the proprietor of the Lakeview Hotel, to commiserate at the bar in the lobby.
Laura, my darling, what is wrong? Nobody drinks at the bar in my hotel alone.
Oh, Lisa, I'd always dreamed that I'd be married here, at the Lakeview. How am I ever going to move on with my life?
Oh, I think you have to get back out there, honey. It doesn't matter if you're young or old. You find love again, or it finds you. I've been divorced so many times and widowed, oh, at least four. But still, I don't think romance is finished with me. And I know you. You're resilient, too. Or my name is at Lisa Miller Hughes, Eldridge Hughes, Shay Coleman, almost Hadley McCall, Mitchell Grimaldi, Chedwin.
But she's also the actress Eileen Fulton.
Do I get the part?
I think you get the part. She's played the role of Lisa on As the World Turns for 50 years. I might be losing Lisa, but it's comforting to know that Eileen Fulton, the dedicated professional behind her all these years, will go on.
I feel like I've been let loose. Free. To fly. To do. Sorry, that's how I feel.
I can't wait to see her next role. It'll have to do now that I've said goodbye to my TV family. Yesterday, I cozied up with the late edition of The Oakdale Intruder at the Java Cafe and headed over to a picnic at the Snyder Farm. I made it over to the Lakeview Hotel just in time for last call. For NPR News, I'm Lara Pellegrinelli in Oakdale.
In a famous line of the TV series The Sopranos, the mobster Tony Soprano says he feels he came in at the end of something. The mafia's mythical era was mostly in the past. Two men deeply involved in The Sopranos are now creating a series about the beginning of big-time organized crime. The series opens in 1920, just as Prohibition took effect. The demand for illegal alcohol vastly increased the power of crime gangs able to supply it. You see that process in the HBO series Boardwalk Empire. Creator Terrence Winter based his story on a history of Atlantic City, New Jersey. Steve Buscemi stars as the political boss Nucky Thompson, who addresses a meeting of his fellow officials.
Friends, fellow members of the city council, as you know, in less than 2 hours, liquor will be declared illegal by decree of the distinguished gentlemen of our nation's Congress. To those beautiful, ignorant bastards.
And then it goes on for a while, gentlemen, but of course that part we can't play. Terrence Winter, would you tell me what drew you to this particular point in history and mob history?
Well, I had obviously worked on The Sopranos for many years, and that was a show that really sort of came in at the end of the mob or organized crime as we knew it in this country. And this sort of was the beginning of that, so it was sort of the flip side. So the 20s is something I've always been fascinated with, and it was just such an exciting time across the board. So much change going on, the end of World War I, women getting the right to vote, Prohibition being enacted, of course, which is where the series begins. Just the great time of upheaval and when I had read about the character Steve plays, Nucky Thompson, this was just such a perfect guy to set a series around.
Well, now explain that, because if you wanted to look at the 1920s and the mob, you could have gone to Chicago, you could have gone to New York. Who was this character that you play, Steve Buscemi?
This character that I play, he was the county treasurer of Atlantic City. But he was more than that. He sort of ran the whole political machine there. Everything had to go through him. He was already making a lot of money, and then when Prohibition hit, he just made so much more money because he was able to bring in all of his bootlegger friends, and they were really excited about Prohibition.
Let me play a clip here from Boardwalk Empire. This is from the first episode, and crime bosses from Chicago and New York have showed up in Atlantic City. They're meeting with Nucky Thompson, and they're talking about trying to obtain alcohol for various reasons at the beginning of Prohibition.
I have a friend, a judge. His daughter's wedding is in a week. I'd like to be able to accommodate him and the 700 guests.
You haven't stockpiled?
All sold already. I'm coming up short.
Well, I have a load coming in tomorrow. 500 crates, Canadian Club. Originally, I planned to keep it, but seeing how I like to start our relationship off on the right foot, how about I let you have it?
How much?
60 grand for the entire load. But you use your own men for the pickup.
Send me over the details. We'll settle up in cash tomorrow.
The first thing that strikes me about that clip, gentlemen, is that Nucky Thompson in that transaction, as the viewer knows, almost doubled his money in one night. And the second thing is that he's talking to real-life gangsters here.
Yeah, it was pleasant surprise as a writer to realize that Nucky actually rubbed elbows with all of these guys. Because he ran a town that was on the Atlantic Ocean and Prohibition was enacted, that became the natural place to import illegal alcohol through. The place was almost a magnet for gangsters of the era. So, you know, for my purposes as a writer, it's very organic. I can have Nucky interact with these people as he did in real life, and it's all completely true.
I'm fascinated by the way that you play this character, Steve Buscemi, Nucky Thompson. Even his posture seems to suggest the contradictions of his character. He's wearing these stiff clothes. He looks like a very upright man, but at the same time, he's kind of sagging. I mean, you get a very physical sense of a guy with a lot of different facets to his character.
Well, the suits help. The suits make you stand up straight. They really do. And I think Nucky is the type of guy who, I mean, he really does enjoy his position and his power. But maybe he didn't quite anticipate that his stress level would also go up. And his attitude was, if this is what the people want, this is what I will provide.
Oh, meaning that was his motivation for getting all kinds of illegal alcohol during Prohibition.
Absolutely. Wow. I mean, of course, he had his own interests. But yeah, he really believed that he was providing a service.
I believe it was Nucky said that if people wanted to come to Atlantic City for Bible readings, he would have given them that. But nobody ever asked for that. But they asked for alcohol, so he would provide that.
Oddly enough, wonder how that worked out. You know, there's another scene that is connected to that meeting of the mobsters. Outside, there's a couple of drivers. And there's a wonderful line, wonderful to me anyway, in which you find out the motivations of one of the principal characters. You can sense his ambition. Would you describe that scene?
Yeah, outside the meeting, the two drivers of Johnny Torrio, who's visiting from Chicago, is having a conversation with Jimmy Darmody, who is Nucky's protege, who's just returned from World War I. And Jimmy has just spent the last 3 years fighting for his country and nearly getting himself killed and has returned to Atlantic City thinking that he's going to pick up where he left off. And the world has sort of moved on without him. And, you know, he sees these other young guys with flashy suits and cars and diamonds and making all this money. And he realizes that there's an opportunity there. So he and this other driver decide to sort of maybe get into that on their own.
Jimmy Darmody's talking about one of the gangsters inside and realizes that guy is rich and says he's not even as old as I am. He's not even as old as we are.
Exactly. The parallels between the illegal alcohol business and the drug trade today are really astounding. When I started to do the research, I realized really quickly that it's almost a perfect overlap. You know, you have young guys who are prone to violence, who want to make a lot of money quickly by trafficking in an illegal substance. I mean, it's essentially the cocaine business, for example. I mean, it was a little more socially acceptable than dealing drugs, for example, but essentially the outcomes were the same.
How long are we going to stay in the 1920s in this series?
Well, the logical endpoint, I mean, or one logical endpoint, because it starts at the dawn of Prohibition, would that it could end at the end of Prohibition, if we were so lucky, but that would be 1933. You know, I would love to be able to explore the entire decade and more if we're lucky enough to be allowed to do that. It was a really just such a rich time, and these characters certainly have a lot of interesting facets to explore.
You're not going to end the series with Nucky Thompson in a diner with his family when a mysterious guy walks up and then things go to black. You're not going to do that.
Well, I was thinking maybe Nucky as an old man could walk into a diner and kill Tony Soprano. That would be a good ending.
Well, gentlemen, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Really
a pleasure.
Writer Terrence Winter and actor Steve Buscemi. The series Boardwalk Empire starts Sunday night on HBO. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer.
Here's a big problem facing a new generation of filmmakers. How do you make a movie that's visually dynamic about people who spend all of their time in front of computers? Two new movies, The Social Network and Catfish, are tackling that challenge, as NPR's Netta Ulaby reports.
Catfish is a documentary. It follows an online romance that takes a turn for the weird.
I mean, she must be pretty awesome, at least from Facebook.
That's Neve Shulman, a cute, personable New Yorker who meets a pretty girl from Michigan online. They chat, they swap apps, and eventually they sext. Shulman says he fell for her without even having met her in real life, IRL.
Every day I was logging into my email and logging onto Facebook and diving into these wall posts, messages, and that was really sort of how the relationship existed for me.
Some of the main characters of the film are computer applications.
That's Catfish documentarian Henry Joost.
Like Facebook, Gmail, and Google Maps, and YouTube, and Google.
Another character is Neve's brother. Ariel Shulman is also one of the filmmakers.
It took us a long time to figure out how to tell this story because so much of the correspondence was over email.
But making correspondence cinematic is actually an old dilemma.
Dearest Lizzie, something has occurred of a most unexpected and serious nature.
From adaptations of Pride and Prejudice to You've Got Mail, directors have labored to film long epistolary passages.
I had a gut feeling you would be online now. I can give you advice. I'm great at advice.
If only you could help.
You've Got Mail was made over a decade ago. IM and laptops were cool and new, and it was fun to watch people use them. With Catfish, filmmaker Henry Joost wanted to avoid already worn-out visuals. Close-ups of keyboards and eyes scanning screens and, God forbid, dial-up noises.
There's sort of a history of movies about life on computers, maybe starting with War Games, that old Matthew Broderick movie. And there's been this whole trope of close-ups of fingers and computers booting up and like bars going across the screen. And they always use these fake interfaces that are not the computer screens that we see in our daily lives.
It's so frustrating as an internet user to watch someone else Google, right? So how do you capture that experience in film?
That's Jessica Pressman, a Yale professor who studies digital culture. She says some of the first movies that really captured the immersive experience of being online include The Matrix and The Net.
In The Net, that 1995 movie with Sandra Bullock, you see the screen, you see what she's engaging with and the information popping up.
Okay, what's this? Terminate all modes, it's ghost files now, terminate. Gotcha, don't I?
You actually get the sense that you are the user and you're not just watching her program. That seems much more engaging than watching someone actually click and navigate.
Likewise, Catfish thrusts its viewers into the forensics of Facebook and YouTube as the hero tries to delve into his sweetheart's offline identity. Filmmaker Ariel Shulman.
We sort of realized that just filming right off of an iPhone screen or a computer screen and right out of your Gmail was cinematic enough. Just the screen itself is very dramatic.
In fact, the filmmakers decided to make real-life scenes more interesting by inserting digital elements. So when the characters are in the car, you see GPS-like graphics mapped onto the actual road. Still, Shulman's co-documentarian Henry Joost says at one point in Aspen, they just couldn't bear to be in a room filming Facebook chats for 1 second longer.
And I remember thinking, you know, we have to get outside and do something. And we took a ski lift up to the top of the mountain and went mountain biking.
But true to a film about the uneasy convergence of internet culture and real life, Neve Shulman brought his cell phone.
just in case his online sweetheart texted him. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
There's a certain predictability to romantic comedies set in New York City. The man and the woman meet cute, as they say. You know, they get into a taxi, they bump into each other on the street while they're carrying packages. And they always have these fabulous apartments. They have interesting jobs and hilarious friends. And after a few misunderstandings, a montage or two, a bunch of coincidences, the couple finally kisses at an iconic location. Cue the Empire State Building. The new film, Jack Goes Boating, is the awkward version of the New York City romance. Philip Seymour Hoffman plays a schlubby limo driver, growing some of the lamest white man dreadlocks I've ever seen. Amy Ryan, probably best known for her role as Holly on The Office, is a telemarketer for a funeral home, and they meet awkward, their dates are frustrating and uncomfortable, but somehow they manage to bumble together into a relationship.
I like talking to you.
I should invite you up, but my place is a mess. I'm going to clean it, and I'll invite you up next time.
Yeah, mine's worse.
Unusually neat. Well, not neat, but not disgusting.
Jack Goes Boating is the first film directed by Philip Seymour Hoffman. He and his co-star Amy Ryan join us from NPR's New York Bureau. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, this film comes from an off-Broadway play that you starred in, Mr. Hoffman, right? And directed also the play?
No, I just acted in it. Peter Dubois directed it.
So why did you choose this as your first film to direct?
Well, it was more of it just kind of chose us. We originated this play at the Labyrinth Theater Company. John Ortiz and I were co-artistic directors of the company at the time. He plays Clyde.
Clyde is your character's friend in the film, and he's the one that sort of helps Jack get confidence and introduces him to Connie.
Peter Seraph from Big Beach and Chris McGurk from Overture, I believe, came and saw the play, and a bunch of other people, I think. And there was a strong interest from these film producers, to make it into a movie based on watching the play, which was great. It wasn't based on reading anything. It was based on actually watching it that they thought, wow, that's a movie. And John Ortiz basically said, well, why don't you direct the film? You know, because I've been directing with the theater company for so many years. I was like, well, maybe. And I thought about it. And then I did start to see it as a film.
John's a great instigator.
Amy, describe your character in the film.
Connie is, she's someone who hasn't had much luck at love. When we meet her, she's at that point in her life where she knows that she needs to make a change. She needs to say yes, even if the butterflies in her stomach would rather her stay home and read a book. But she knows it's now or never, so she accepts a dinner date, not knowing anything about this man named Jack that her friend Lucy is going to set her up with.
Lucy is Clyde's wife in the film. She also works with Connie in the funeral home, and she's played by Daphne Rubin Vega.
And it goes pretty bad. Well, you know, she has a near nervous breakdown in the bathroom, you know, 10 minutes into the dinner. But yet, he's still there.
Well, I want to play a clip of that terribly uncomfortable first date that the two of you have in the movie. The character of Connie is talking about her father, who was in a coma and then miraculously
as she would,
comes out of it.
On a first date.
On a first date.
Talked in a soft voice, you know? And I thought, oh, well, he's in a zombie state, you know, where you stay around because there's some unfinished business you're responsible for, you know, like taking care of my mom.
Yeah, your mom, of course.
He went back to be with her at Village Care Facility.
You know, that's... God. Got up from a coma and went home.
And then he fell down and hit his head in the hallway, and then he died.
I have to say, when I saw this in the movie theater, I laughed a huge belly laugh out loud and then looked around to make sure that I was supposed to be laughing. because at this point in the film, you don't know is this a comedy? Is this serious? Am I the only one who thought that this was a hilarious moment? But I have to ask, this is one of those difficulties of the character. You're sad, you're lonely, but you also provide most of the laughs in the film. How did you balance this uncomfortable humor?
Well, I try to just play the truth of her, really. And I mean, I knew it was funny reading it as well. Humor comes from tragedy, really.
Yeah.
Well, Philip Seymour Hoffman, you're sitting there in the scene. You're in just about every scene in the movie, and you're also directing it. So as you're directing that scene in particular, the first date scene, are you concentrating on what you're doing and seeing it from outside, from the director's perspective?
That was about halfway into the shoot, three-quarters of the way into the shoot, that scene.
So you were getting good at it.
No, it wasn't that. No, I struggled throughout with the acting and directing at the same time. But I had to keep an eye, you know, so I had to kind of figure out how we were going to shoot it. And so when the camera wasn't going to be on me, how I could still be off camera and be the other actor for them, but also kind of have a third eye. And that was when I would try to take advantage of that. Yeah, I'd be off camera and I'd have to give Amy a note or a suggestion. You know what I mean? About some. In fact, in that scene, I think there was a one part where we did a bunch of times, you remember?
Yeah.
And one of the takes we use, it's a really great take near the end before you run into the bathroom, is the take that you stopped. You know, she wanted to do it again, and I was like, actually, that was really good.
I must have been getting to somewhere too personal.
Yeah, I was
too
like,
screw this.
But that's kind of what happens a lot. That's why you have directors, because the actors, the better they get sometimes, the more unaware of themselves they are, which is, you know, why you want a third eye there.
But the right thing always does. The right thing doesn't always feel comfortable.
I should say the title of the film, Jack Goes Boating, refers to Jack's desire to take Connie on a boating date in Central Park. But first he has to learn how to swim. But that means, Philip, you spend a lot of time in a bathing suit. As a director, were you ever tempted to shoot yourself from a little more flattering angles?
Human beings up close and personal are the way they look up close and personal.
Did you notice his Botox?
You know, I feel very strongly about that. And I feel that, you know, some guy who, you know, is 43, who doesn't know how to cook, you know, who drives a limo for a living and lives in a basement apartment is, you know, going to be out of shape. And he's going to be a little bit blotchy, and, you know, he's trying to do something with his hair that he think will be cool, but it's not working out so well. And that's the way he looks, you know what I mean? So it'd be pretty weird to try to, if I started shooting the scene based on how I wanted to look, you know, and how that and those swimming pool scenes are essential to the relationship between Jack and Clyde, that you see these two men be gentle with each other.
That's good, but Jack, that's good, but go under. Make the bubbles under the water, then come up, take a breath, and go under, bubbles, come up, and get a rhythm going. We'll do it together. You ready? But it's good. You ready? Breath.
Under!
Well, you speak about your character's relationship with his friend Clyde as if it's the love story at the center of the film.
I think it is. It is. I mean, I don't think it's the primary story, but I think all three stories, there are three relationships happening, you know, Jack and Connie and then Clyde and Lucy and Jack and Clyde. All three of them hold the same kind of weight, really, you know, in order for the Jack Connie to actually pay off, you know, ultimately you feel the evolution of the guy's story just as much as you feel the evolution of any of the other stories. And that was very important to me.
Well, Amy, you've seen Philip Seymour Hoffman go from film actor to film director. Does this tempt you to try your hand at directing?
Oh, no. I don't have that broader view of the big picture. Yeah, I'm a good champion for a character through that story. I'll defend them, but it's hard for me to take responsibility for the whole story. So, no, it's a skill I do not possess. But I am absolutely in awe of Phil for doing this and doing it beautifully.
Philip Seymour Hoffman is the director and star of the new film, Jack Goes Boating. He joined us with his co-star, Amy Ryan, from NPR's New York Bureau. Thank you both so much for coming in. This was great.
Thank you.
Jack Goes Boating opens in select cities this weekend and across the country starting Friday, September 24th.
Oh. A world-renowned hip-hop shop that specializes in vinyl records is closing its last retail outlet in Los Angeles this weekend. The original store in New York closed earlier this month. And as Corey Takahashi reports, the end of Fat Beats represents the end of an era.
Nazareth Nirza slumps over the cashier's counter at Fat Beats LA. Nirza is a hip-hop DJ who goes by the name Rhetmatic. He's worked here for the past 15 years, among other luminary DJs and producers.
The DJ's the backbone of hip-hop, and they play vinyl, you know. So we were catering to the DJs and to any hip-hop aficionados, you know. So
what's left in L.A. and New York City in terms of strictly vinyl hip-hop spots now?
I mean, if you're talking about hip-hop spots, nothing.
The reason vinyl matters so much in hip-hop, compared to, say, classical or country, is because vinyl in hip-hop is an instrument itself. The foundational sound of hip-hop came from DJs who dug through tons of vinyl to come up with perfect samples. The audio archaeology of crate digging lives on among the hip-hop faithful. But Nirza says a successful independent hip-hop artist today might be lucky to sell 500 vinyl units. Back in the 90s, good sales for the same artist were often 20 times higher in vinyl. Michael Buchanan, whose DJ name is House Shoes, is a closing manager for Fat Beats LA.
The MP3, it's just a computer file. It's like a Word document or a JPEG. It's really no different. You know, you're not going to be like, oh man, I remember when he emailed that file to me. Man, it was class. I still got the email he sent it to me in. No, you don't do that.
Student DJ Jamie Fisher uses real vinyl as well as technology that approximates old-school scratching and mixing through time codes linked to digital files.
Like, funk is about being around the beats, next to the beats. It's not about being on beat. And a lot of times if you're doing, say you just hit the button on the computer, it'll go right on beat. So you lose the funk of DJing.
Fisher is still eager to learn from the hip-hop canon. Tonight, he's at Fat Beats on Melrose Avenue, shopping for vinyl. Grimy underground mixes pipe through the speakers of Fat Beats. Store manager Michael Buchanan lights a cigarette and tells stragglers it's closing time for the day.
Let's move.
Then, he sets upon his swan song on two spinning circles of sound. For NPR News, I'm Corey Takahashi.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to NPR's arts channel at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.